Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. Readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence. With me, Ernest Hancock, and my very, 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 very special guest, I'm very happy to bring to you, Michael Biafore. He is the author of Rocketeers. Now, one, you know, a little warning, I want to let you guys know this. Rocketeers was published in 2007. It's been a few years since then that so much innovation has happened in the private race for Mars. I mean, the outer planet, we're going to space and government is so not invited. Now, what we're going to be talking about today are the kinds of people, the philosophy, the innovation, where we are, what the involvement of government has been, what it can be. Is it having, or you just want them out of the way? Or is there a role that they can play? Or is it going to be an America thing? Is it going to be a humanity thing? Well, someone that has been spending time with the very people that have, you know, I had no idea until I read his book just how mature the private space race was even before Spaceship One broke the barrier. They had a private citizen, no government money, went to space and back, did it again within 2 weeks to win the Anasari X Prize. Now, there is, and a lot of it has been NASA engineers and stuff, people, you know, the big brain box people saying, look, man, we're not going to make it to space in our lifetime if we don't do it ourselves. They went out, they used their minds to make a lot, in a lot of these cases, in fact, they used the private market and the internet and innovation to make the money so they could go to space. It's been amazing to see what has happened and how quick. Now, let's get right to it because we only got an hour, Michael, and I could go on for days. Those that listen to the show, you know that's true. So we'll go ahead and go. Michael, I got you there.
Hey, how are you?
I am more than wonderful. Tell me. You know, the type of minds, the first thing I want to know, the type of people that we're dealing with here, they are just innovators, American ingenuity? Are they great representations of humanity's cream of the crop? I mean, why are they so interested in getting off planet? What drives them?
It's all of the above, and it's all the things that have built this country. You know, the kinds of people who put automobiles on assembly lines, created the internet, the telephone, all these things that we have that came out of this spirit, and it's this spirit of can-do American ingenuity is alive and well, and you know, one of the greatest success stories of this is a guy named Elon Musk, and he just absolutely epitomizes this whole idea. You know, he's South African, came here penniless to this country, became a citizen, and built up an internet business out of nothing, made millions, and now he's running the company, SpaceX, Space Exploration Technologies, that's going to replace the space shuttle with a private vehicle. And he wants to do it so that we can extend humanity beyond planet Earth, ultimately colonize Mars. That's where he's headed.
Oh, and big dreams. I like big dreams. Me and big dreams were buddies, okay? Now, these people, let's go ahead and start with where it really started was probably we're looking in the late 90s. It kind of became the understanding of the people that wanted to do this that they weren't going to wait anymore. They're just going to do it on their own. Can you kind of give us a chronology, walk us through? Now, while you're talking, I have a bunch of photos of when we were out at Mojave and the first launch of Spaceship One and a lot of the spacecraft that we have right now. We have a lot of the pictures from different events and engine tests. And we're just going to let those roll for the YouTube audience to see just the kinds of things that are already going on right, not later. So during that, why don't you go ahead and walk us through from, say, the late 90s and the major players in this, because you have went and interviewed and photographed and done articles for major magazines on this whole process. Please, walk us through it.
Sure, yeah. There was a whole cadre of people who grew up during the what I call the first space age, the government space age, you know, going to the moon, who grew up with the belief that, hey, by the time they grew up, they were going to be going to Mars and the moon and everything like that themselves. Instead, what happened was it turned out to be just a flash in the pan. Once the moon was achieved, NASA lost its direction. The government was no longer that terribly interested in human exploration of space. So a lot of these folks grew up pretty frustrated and decided to make it happen themselves. The government wasn't going to do it for them. So we had Paul Allen, who's one of the brains behind Microsoft and, of course, worth millions of dollars, decided he was going to fund Burt Rutan's company, Scaled Composites, in its bid to win the Ansari X Prize, which was generated by Peter Diamandis, another one of these folks who really wanted to go to space himself, was tired of waiting for the government to get him there. In fact, he wanted to be a NASA astronaut initially, Peter Diamandis, and realized pretty quickly that the options there were very limited. You know, very few people who even apply to the program even get to be astronauts, and of those, not that many even get to fly. So he decided he was going to create a prize, and that was inspired by Charles Lindbergh and his race across the Atlantic Ocean, because it was a race, to win the prize of his day, the X Prize of his day. That basically jump-started the commercial airline industry. So you had all these people coming together, Peter Diamandis, and of course there are other players in this too. I'd like to talk about them too, but this is kind of where the modern commercial spaceflight era got started. Peter Diamandis wants to put a prize out there to encourage private innovation in space, and the prize stipulated that no one who competed could get government funding. And Burt Rutan, owner of Scaled Composites, an aircraft company out in Mojave, California, had the, eventually the winning entry in this prize, and Paul Allen financing it. So he had financier, a visionary, and an engineer all coming together. Of course, the pilots who flew Spaceship One all came together to prove definitively, once and for all, you don't need the government to get to space. And that just opened up the door to all kinds of new financing, new innovation, and a lot of ideas that had been kicking around for a long time finally got some traction, started to take off.
Well, what were some of the hurdles that they really had to take care of? I mean, you know, one of the things is just propulsion. You know, we gotta have a rocket engine that's going to get us up there. And they got a lot of, you had the people with the money and the dream, and the main thing is they're able to run businesses and coordinate, and they're looking at NASA's budget, and they're going, you know, two things. One, they waste a lot of money. And two, they would pass up innovation and better ways of doing things in exchange for congressman special interest kind of military industrial complex. We want this contract as opposed to actually having something that worked better. So when you have people that come across and they're just like, I'm so done. And then they see an opportunity to go into the private space travel. They're going, yep, done. I'm over here now. So this kind of thing, what was one of the things that we need to talk about are the rocket engines. Who made the biggest innovation there?
Well, he doesn't toot his horn this way, and Burt Bertan certainly doesn't do it for him. But I met a guy named Tim Pickens out in Huntsville, Rocket City. Another one of these folks who grew up during the space age. His dad worked on Apollo. He figured, well, when I get big enough, I'm going to work on rockets too. And as he described it to me later, by the time he came up, it was as though a bunch of aliens had come down to Huntsville, Alabama, built a bunch of cool stuff, and then left. So he decided to start building his own rockets in his garage. And Burt Rutan, as I describe the story in my book, went out to Huntsville figuring, okay, that's Rocket City, USA. Let me find some propulsion guys out there to power up my spacecraft.
Yeah, that's a good place to break. We're going to be, they wanted to go to space. And you just get the guy, you got the money. I went and made the money. Now let's go do it. We're doing it. We are so doing it. You guys stay right there. We're going to show you how, where, and who. Man, oh, today's the show. We'll be right back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day here from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com here in Phoenix, Arizona. Man, let's get right to it. Now, the author of Rocketeers, I have on Michael Beauforé, and he's also the author of Just Being Released in Paperback, The Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World from the Internet to Artificial Limbs. Yeah, they're remaking it all right. We'll talk about that. We'll have you back on that another day. But today, what I want to talk about, the future. Now, the thing is that rocket technology that we're using, even now, 50 years later, is essentially, hasn't changed. It's the same. We're still doing Model T stuff, are we not?
That's right. Yeah. And that's why, it's really a fallacy that most of the mainstream still believes that only a big government program can get us into space, into low orbit, low Earth orbit, and beyond. We've grown up with this idea that it's got to be NASA or some massive government program. But in fact, the technology's been around for decades. And one of the rocketeers put it to me this way: it's as though right now we're trying to build automobiles, but we have no infrastructure. So every shop that wants to build a car has to go out and machine their own, their own wheels, manufacture their own tires, their own spark plugs, somehow create their own wiring, do all that stuff without the benefit of an industry, an infrastructure to source things from. And in fact, that's exactly what SpaceX is doing. This is the company that's currently in the lead for sending astronauts into orbit, private company. They've just moved everything in-house. They're doing what Ford did early on in the beginning. It's just creating everything under one roof and driving the cost down. So once that kind of activity becomes more common, then it's just economies of scale and an infrastructure out there that supports space travel, and then suddenly it's just going to be just like the airline industry or trucking or anything like that.
Well, now that brings us to, we have up on the graphic now, the Rocket Racing League. And tell us about that and why they wanted to do that to kind of spur this innovation. Talk about the Rocket Racing League.
The Rocket Racing League is another brainchild of Peter Diamandis, who created the X Prize that Burt Rutan's Guild Composites won back in 2004, with the first privately funded space shot with a person on it. And he's getting at just what I'm talking about. He's saying, okay, now we've proven, we've removed the giggle factor, as they used to call it. It's no longer considered laughable that a private company or small team of people without a massive amount of taxpayer money can actually go to space. Now let's work on making it affordable to the rest of us. Let's try to create that infrastructure so that each shop doesn't have to create its own one-off vehicle at an enormous cost. So the Rocket Racing League is an attempt to do this by creating a NASCAR-style league with rocket-powered airplanes and with competing teams from all across the U.S. and perhaps beyond that would start to create demand for these kinds of components. I'm talking about rocket engines, pumps, these kinds of things that can then be sourced by other companies to do more than just racing with rocket-powered airplanes.
Yeah, so you can go to, you know, Napa Space Parts and just order what you want to get and make in your garage.
That's right. Yeah, and we were talking before the break, too, about how the propulsion system for Spaceship One got started. And this is a good example of what I'm talking about. You know, Burt Rutan built airplanes with scaled composites. He had figured out how to build a space plane, but his company never got into the propulsion business. They were like Boeing, you know, they'd create the airframe and do all that stuff and then go source the engines somewhere else. And he went out trying to find this infrastructure. He figured, well, it's got to be out there. Got to be able to just find some rocket engine, you know, off the shelf somewhere. And he couldn't. And what he ended up doing was finding this guy, Tim Pickens, who was building rocket engines in his garage. And he really liked his technology, his hybrid rocket technology, where you have a solid fuel propellant that's fueled, gets oxygen from nitrous oxide. So it's this hybrid approach where you got liquid nitrous oxide and a solid fuel. And he had this rocket-powered bicycle, actually used roofing tar. And I love that story because
you add oxygen to anything that'll burn, and it burns fast.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of that system is if you shut off that oxygen supply, the whole system shuts off immediately. So it's got a built-in safety where Tim would have his hand clamped on the flow switch for the nitrous, and if he got bumped off or if anything happened, all he had to do was release that switch, and the machine would stop running. Burt Rutan really liked that because he had just seen a demonstration of a liquid-powered rocket engine, pure liquid, just more traditional, that just exploded. And he didn't like that idea at all. So he decided to go with the hybrid approach. He brought Tim out to Mojave to be the first manager on the propulsion side of things. And that's still the same kind of propulsion they're using for their second-generation vehicle. Space.
You know, let me go ahead and describe this for the audience so they kind of get an idea what we're talking about. Because it was, I tell you a little bit of history, Michael. This is where I came. We're up near the break, so I'll take a couple of minutes to kind of give you my perspective on this. It was the summer of 1998, I think it was. I was in Washington, D.C. for a wedding of my brother-in-law, and I brought my four children. We had to go to the Air and Space Museum. So let them just run around, whatever, and I waited at the entrance exit there, the big glass wall, and in between the doors where nobody would see it was this little monument that described the Anasari X Prize. No government money, to space, back, do it again, 2 weeks, only 10% of the weight of the craft minus the fuel be changed, boom, done. I go, oh, here we go, because I understood what that was, too. It's a Lindbergh thing. When I heard that Burt Rutan in, it was the summer of 03, I think, when it was announced that he was getting involved in this thing and had Paul Allen's money, I go, I don't even know if I knew about Paul Allen then, but I knew Burt Rutan. I've been following him since I graduated high school in 79, following all his designs on all the science magazines and so on. I'm like, oh yeah, baby, we're going. Well, what happened was he came up with the idea to fuel it. The rocket motor was, for people, just so you kind of get an understanding, imagine a soda can that's just solid rubber. Now, there's a hole, like you just take a straw and you put it right down the length in the center of the soda can, and at the end of it, you got an liquid oxygen that would feed through that hole, and at the end on the other side is the rocket nozzle. When you ignite with the oxygen and the rubber hit together, or your tar or whatever it would prop up, hola, whatever, some hydrocarbon something, it's a solid. So what happens is it burns, and it burns fast. And you can throttle how much oxygen that you're allowing to go to the rocket nozzle. And if you shut off the oxygen, it shuts off. You turn on the oxygen, you can reignite it, turn it on, turn it off. To have a throttleable rocket engine in a solid form, a hybrid like that, man, that was simple, simple, simple. And I'm going, yeah, baby, that's the key. Because all you have to do is refuel the liquid oxygen tank. You keep that on the spacecraft and put another plug of rubber in there, and you're ready to go again. If they had to, I'll bet you they could do it the same day. Oh, you see where we're going? You guys stay right there. We got a lot more stuff to talk about. Space stations, Two of them in orbit, private, no government funding, right, not later. Right now, over your head, right now, never heard about it, did you?
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here each and every day on the LRN.FM network. You know, I'm really excited. I've been just on pins and needles ever since I got for Christmas the book, Rocketeer. Now, the author, Michael Bifore, is with us, and I'm so glad that you had the time to come and talk to us, because you're still involved in the private space race. You're in contact with these guys. You help hook me up with some phone numbers and everything, and people that we can talk to, and I know a lot of people, they want to go, and some of them got some money, so they're going to go. So I just, you know, tell me about the commercialization of this. Has there been a lot of, and we'll get back to the engine and so on, but I mean, just real quick, you know, is there a demand? Is there a pent-up demand to go to space and people with money that are willing to part with it to be able to go?
Oh, there's absolutely a demand. That was the big wild card with all this. You know, we can prove that private industry can get to space without, you know, huge government backing, but you know, if we build it, will they come? That was the, you know, the naysayers always have some stumbling block. You know, first it's, oh, well, private enterprise can never do this. And then it's like, oh, well, if we build it, they'll never come. And, oh, well, we've done suborbital flight. That was easy. Now they'll never get to orbit. You know, one by one, these things have been demolished. And, one of the biggest is there a market demand for this? And there are a lot of people out there. Right now, you can buy a ticket on Spaceship Two through Virgin Galactic for $200,000, and that's just the first generation of suborbital tourism, and that price is going to keep dropping as they build more vehicles and competition gets into play.
Now, the graphic I have up now is a picture of Spaceship One and Burt Rutan there. Now, his whole thing, of course, he wants to go, and he's become like a Boeing. I mean, he's manufacturing the airframe, a fleet for Richard Branson of Virgin Galactic now, which is, you know, a big promoter guy, man. He's like, ooh, we're going to have some fun with this. And I hear tell that he's going to be in the first flight going up. I mean, if that's an endorsement of the safety.
That's what they want. Yeah. Branson, his mom, who's, you know, elderly by now, his kids, Branson's kids, Burt Rutan wants to go up. And, you know, I believe they will. They're dreamers in the best sense of the word, and they're going to blaze the way, and it's just going to be tremendously exciting. When people actually see other people going up who aren't government employees on a regular basis, I think people will get excited about space again. You know, you mentioned before the break, well, most people have never heard of the Bigelow space stations, the test modules that are up there right now in orbit, and the one big size ones that are being built now. It's because people have kind of lost interest in space. They've gotten used to the idea that, well, space is just a bunch of government employees flying in circles around planet Earth.
I don't believe that. I do not believe that for a second. It is, I will get the lamestream media, the media that's so last century, telling me about every single weather delay of the space shuttle, but I don't hear a word about there's two private space stations up there right not later.
Here's another example of that. Okay, so just last month, SpaceX, Space Exploration Technologies, their orbital company, going all the way to low Earth orbit, well, they for the first time, they sent a space capsule big enough for seven astronauts. It's America's first space capsule design since Apollo. They successfully put this thing into orbit, orbited it for two turns around the Earth, and brought it back within half a mile of its target. And during the countdown, they found a crack in the second stage rocket nozzle. And if this had been a NASA mission, chances are they would have had to scrub the whole thing. They would have had to roll that thing back into the hangar. They would have had to, you know, endlessly go over paperwork, figure out, okay, when's our next launch window. Instead, because this was a private venture that didn't need all that kind of BS dragging it down, they just sent a guy out from their headquarters out near Los Angeles, flew him out to Cape Canaveral. The guy looked at it and goes, yep, all we need to do is shave off a few inches off this nozzle and we're good to go again. And they went up and they did it.
You know, this, what I'm showing now is the 9 Merlin engine. The reason they call it that, you know, this is interesting. This is Elon Musk, which is the PayPal. That's where he made his money.
Right.
So he goes, I'm going to space. I did PayPal so I can go to space. You know, that's what this is all about. You know, no, I wasn't even having it on there. Let me go ahead and show this. I was sitting there showing me. Okay, now this is a the spaceship engine mount of the 9 Merlin engines. Now, what they do is that they had to test the one. I mean, that was Falcon 1 that they eventually, because they had, you know, the Navy is going to launch, you know, on another pad way over. Well, you can't launch because we're going to launch and we got delays, so you got to wait. And they screw it, man. They put it on a barge or whatever and take it out to some Pacific island. And I remember when they did this a year and a half or so ago, that or 2 years, we ran that on Freedom's Phoenix Live, that launch, and 10, 9, 8, and we're going, ooh, and then it had a malfunction on one of the coupling things and so on, and they got that fixed. And then now that they got the engine designed, they're going, okay, we put 9 of these together. Guess what? We're going to the moon, okay? So I'm going, all right, now they have this engine. Tell us about the development of that engine. The cost would have been astronomical. All of the problems, all of the ouch, quit it paperwork and stuff. And so they bypassed that. And now, man, they rocket sledded into having a rocket engine. So go ahead and tell us the early development of that, Merlin.
Just, to put it in perspective, each space shuttle flight is now up to about $1.5 billion. That's just for one flight. That's not developing a vehicle. It's nothing. It's just flying the same one. Whereas SpaceX went from just total blank slate, literally the prototype for the Merlin engine started out in the propulsion chief's garage. This guy named Tom Mueller, who was working with a bunch of amateurs out in Mojave while he was working at a defense contractor during the day. And Elon Musk, who wanted to start a rocket company, found him, literally just walked into the garage one day and said, hey, can you build me one of these bigger? They went from that to getting, you know, filling an empty warehouse, clean design, build prototypes, test them out. They have a test facility out in Texas, flying those early missions with just the one engine, working out the kinks, all the way through last month, orbiting America's first space capsule since Apollo to a perfect test flight, absolutely flawless. They did all that for about $800 million. So $800 million for all that versus $1.5 billion for one space shuttle launch.
There was one story in your book I thought was very instructive. When you're talking about the shuttle and they eventually decided on solid rocket boosters, during that time, there was a team that was looking for other alternatives. And they came up with liquid methane and oxygen, I think it was liquid oxygen, that would be a third the weight, a third the size. And, you know, I don't know if they could have had it reusable, but it was a lot cheaper, a lot better, have more payload and everything. They just didn't want it. Nope. We got this, big company over, and they kept reducing their price and doing what because they can. It was a political decision.
Yeah, and that's how NASA came into being. You know, to get to the moon, it was going to be a huge undertaking. And, it was kind of a smart way to do it. They spread the risk out across a whole bunch of different states and companies. So NASA has all these centers all over the country and all these different contractors all over the country. So it would be really hard to kill the moon program because you'd have to kill all of those centers and all of those contractors individually. And so that's what got the moon program done. But now we're left with this legacy of this enormous bureaucracy and lots of money going to lots of different constituencies. And it's just probably going to be just about impossible to dismantle that thing. So,
okay, in just a couple of minutes that we got here, we have just a real fast discussion here. This is, from in your mindset, is that, well, it took a country. It took the inspiration of JFK and money and NASA, and we're going to collectivize it. And the goal, of course, was political in opposition to the Soviet Union and Soyuz and everything. And when we come back, I'll let you respond. But, I'm of the opinion I would be flying around in my Jetson car right freaking now if it wasn't for government sapping all the resources and the mind and innovation and just the intellectual curiosity of the people into the service of government. Just get them out of the, I don't even want them there. And we'll get a response from Michael when we come back here in just a little bit on Declare Your Independence.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Fighting for here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, in Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. How about that? You know, we just declare our independence. Let me tell you, it's really easy to do. I declare my independence. See how easy that was? And you don't even need a government form. That's the only way you can do it, as a matter of fact. And you don't need to do it with me. Just do it on your own. It's all a state of mind. And one of those things is the only way you can be independent is if you're not dependent. And if you're not dependent on the man or the government or your fellow citizens, fellow humanity, you know, out there, you got to put a gun to their head to take their money for you to do your dream, you know, then you're free to do whatever you want as long as you're not using coercion. You're not making people do stuff, no matter how great the idea is. And that's what these people did. They went out, they made their money non-coercively, and they said, you know what, it's my money. I'm going to do what I want with my money. And in the process of making my money, the government got a whole bunch of day money. But, you know, the thing is, I got enough. I'm going to do what I want. And one of the things that they wanted to do, go to space. Somebody was in the way. I want to find out how in the way they are. Now, who better than Michael Before? He wrote the book Rocketeers. Now, this is the private space race. Now, go ahead, Michael. You know, tell us about, you know, are they getting a... I don't know. Is the government encouraging? Are they, you know, allowing it? Are they starting to put up roadblocks? They got legislation. What kind of role are they playing?
Well, this is really interesting now. This is a developing story, one to watch, because right now NASA is in a real fix. I mean, the space shuttle is retiring this year, and there's nothing to replace it. They have sunk about $10 billion into what was supposed to be the next government spaceship, and it has yet to fly. Just not going anywhere. Meanwhile, all these private companies are building their ships for relative peanuts, and they're going to start flying astronauts soon. So the only option NASA and the government has at this point, the only one, in spite of what certain congresspeople and senators would have us believe, is to hire private companies to fly their own ships. So they'll charter flights, just like on an airline. The other option is to buy rides off the Russians, which they've done in the past, and they're going to continue doing. But it's just a horribly embarrassing situation. I mean, here we are, you know, beat the Russians to the moon in 69. Now we have to bum rides off them. And it's just a ridiculous state of affairs. So we're at this real critical juncture in history right now where it looks as though NASA is either going to get run over by the bus or just going to have to get on board it and pay a fare just like everybody else.
You know, what was interesting to me is when SpaceX launched Dragon and they had their own space capsule and they go, yes, they have the capacity. They've achieved it. They can go to the International Space Station. Yay. And I'm like, what the heck do they want to go there for?
That's right. There's another player in all this, Robert Bigelow out in Las Vegas, is building his own private space program, and he's focused on the destination. He's building what will become the first commercial space station very far along. He basically took over a NASA program that just got let go. So many of these great ideas start at NASA, and then it seems to me mainly political contractor, you know, reasons. They've got these major contractors to maintain. In that case, it was Boeing, who had a competing design for a module they were going to put on the space station. Anyway, that's the backstory. But Bigelow took over this program. It was called Transhab. It was originally intended to help astronauts go to the moon. It involves inflatable vehicles that would be in orbit and would make great space stations because you could launch them in a rolled-up configuration on a smaller vehicle than you would otherwise have to build. And then once it's up there in orbit, it can expand into several times its original volume. And these things are going to go up probably around 2014. They've got two test modules in orbit now. They've tested out the all the principles behind it.
And these are huge, huge, because they can expand. Once they get up there, they just kind of inflate, but they're Kevlar. You know, they can take a freaking bullet round, and so they're even more protected than the modules they have at SSI right now.
That's right. Yeah, the aluminum construction is actually fairly fragile. I mean, if a micrometeorite hits it, it's going to puncture it, whereas these are made of bulletproof fabrics that are just not going anywhere. They've tested these things in their testing facility in Las Vegas by actually firing essentially bullets at them and found that they're quite robust. And it's just tremendously exciting. I mean, we're really on the cusp of a new age in space exploration, and it's going to happen with or without the government's help. And we're finally at that juncture where that's the case, and that's what makes it so exciting.
Well, Bigelow, let's talk about him a little bit. He is the owner of Budget Suites out of Las Vegas, and he's always wanted to go, and he made his money in development and doing whatever and building long-term hotel rooms, really. And what happened is that, you know, he had the ability to run a business, and he goes, I'm going to put cheap motels in space and do exactly the same kind of thing. We're going to have a facility that you can go and rent by the week or cheaper by the month or year or whatever, and put them, and they butt up end-to-end to each other. You can have a big string of single wide mobile home trailers in space. I mean, you know, we're going to space, and you can take and move those with maneuvering rockets themselves into lunar orbit. You can go do any. I mean, it's already done in the minds of these people that are making it happen. And all, like you say, all the naysayers, all the congressmen, all the NASA, how are we going to carve off a big giant chunk of money for us? Well, maybe you're not. You know, you're just not. So this, and you're talking about, you know, the PayPal guy, Musk, you know, his whole reasoning behind doing his rockets is to go to Mars and do a colony.
Yeah, he's thinking big, and he's young, too. He's got a lot of time. And
he's in his 30s.
I do think the government does have some role to play. We were talking about this a little bit offline.
What?
That there are projects that, you know, as I talk about in my book, the Department of Mad Scientists, about DARPA, there are projects that just are not going to be feasible for private industry because of their long time frame.
So I disagree. It's going to be exactly the same thing, Michael, as you see in the space race at NASA. They're going to come up with this idea of, you know, zero point energy fusion laser making impulse engine, DALA, whatever the heck it is. And they'll go, that's a great idea. But even if we do it, we're going to keep it for the U.S. and the military, and the civilians never even get to know it exists.
There's always that risk. And with NASA, you know, NASA doesn't have a great track record that way. But there's another agency, DARPA, which could be a model for this, because they specialize in fostering technologies and then letting them loose into the wild.
When they feel like it. When they feel like it. How many examples do you need?
Well, there's certainly things that are classified that we don't know about, and who knows what.
Why? It's my tax money. How come they're classified? Explain that to me. How did they get classified? They use my money to make this stuff, and they go, oh, no, this is classified because of, you know, the always encompassing national security. I'm like, you know what? Then give me my money back. Government doesn't work. I want my money back.
Sure. I hear you. But look at the Internet. DARPA funded the Internet in the 60s. And it took until the mid-90s before we could all use it. But it would never have been created without
Again, that. I counter you with Richard Branson's going to buy all these bankrupt communication satellites in the name of, you know, a philanthropic effort to internet all the poor children in Africa. And I'll tell you what's going to happen. That's one reason why we were so adamant about encouraging the private space race, because we knew that it gives us the ability to put our own communication satellites into orbit bypassing the Internet. Goodbye, Internet. You want to control Internet 1, 2, 3? Well, we got Internet 37. Now what?
I hear you.
You're not going to convince me that the involvement of government is going to have a net benefit result for any of us. So we'll do this conversation more on this line when we talk about, we'll go ahead and schedule you for, and we'll pump your book, the Department of Mad Scientists, and I'm, you know, your DARPA book. I can see we're going to have some fun with that one.
That sounds good.
But let's go ahead and talk about real quick in just a couple of minutes that we have, the next year. 2011, 2012, we're going to see a bunch of people in space, are we?
Not quite yet. We're going to see cargo flights by SpaceX to the International Space Station, if all goes well. And by 2014, we'll see humans on those craft. By the way, those were built to carry cargo, but they all have windows on them. So Musk has been planning from day one to put people on those things. And coincidentally, that's around the time Bigelow plans to have his commercial space stations up, 2014. We'll also have commercial flights to suborbital space. We might see test flights to suborbital space on Spaceship Two this year.
Spaceship Two! Richard Branson, man, we're going to have some fun. You know, thanks for coming on, Michael. Michael Before, author of Rocketeers.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Go get the book. I enjoyed it. And tell you what's really coming. And it's, it's here. We'll be right back. Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. Readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.